of our application that's running. And we're going to call this application an enclave, or that application is in an enclave. And when you run this application, you're able to run it remotely on a piece of trusted hardware, even though it's running untrusted software otherwise. And you're able to get back a report, a remote attestation report, that is able to prove to you that it is running both correctly and properly isolated on this hardware.
Okay, hang on one second. Just to interrupt. We are recording the meeting at this point.
Okay, so. That's fine. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
So TEs are a cornerstone security perimeter, really. They let you build a whole lot of different stuff on top of them. They give you kind of this set of maximal security and privacy guarantees with a minimal set of trust. You're able to have your system built on top of a TE kind of authenticate itself from the device. You can authenticate the software. You get to these, as I said, these guarantees of integrity and confidentiality, even on remote execution. And, you know, kind of the classical model here is cloud context. And these give you the ability to build lots of kind of new security applications at cheaper costs than you might have otherwise. So you can think about, you know, sensor networks where you want the data coming off of the sensors to be guaranteed to be accurate, to be signed and authenticated, but your little IoT nodes are running who knows what in terms of other software. The one very popular case right now is confidential computing in the cloud. So people want to be able to do machine learning in the cloud, and they want to not leak their machine learning models and data to even their own cloud provider. TEs are one of these mechanisms that can provide those types of guarantees. So there's lots of TEs out there. Keystone is very far from the only one. There's a wide variety of commercial offerings, kind of going back to ARM's Trust Zone, which is now what runs in essentially everyone's smartphones. They kind of have their model. A little bit later, we've got Intel's SGX, obviously, which is now version 2 is just starting to roll out kind of widely. I think in the past year, you've now been able to buy chips. Intel is the one, right, who has the Enclave model as kind of, that was where that really became popularized. NVIDIA has stuff in this space. AMD has something that's more focused on virtual machine isolation rather than application isolation, but kind of everybody is building something like that. So what we're building is a set of tools to build TEs for RISC-V based platforms at Berkeley. There's also a lot of other people out there trying to use TEs or build their own on top of other systems out there, or build middleware on them. This is a like rapidly expanding kind of space right now. So we're going to kind of go over what we mean when we say customizable TEs, which is how we talk about a lot of what Keystone does. And then we're going to go through kind of the actual Keystone framework, talk about our core security component, which is the secure monitor, and then go over some of the components that we've built on top of that. So the thing I want to get across here first is that Keystone is a framework for TEs. We're not a specific instance of a TE. So when we talk about building a Keystone-based TE, what we mean is, given a particular piece of RISC-V hardware that someone has built that is Keystone compatible, what is the Enclave system or TE that you have built for that using Keystone? Different platforms plus Keystone will result in different looking TEs. We require no microarchitectural changes to RISC-V. That's standard RISC-V cores will operate, and kind of minimal added hardware. And what I mean by that is something like a secure boot mechanism or a measured boot mechanism. We need a root of trust there. We need some way to securely store keys. That's pretty much it. Everything else we can do in software. Why do we want these customizable TEs? Well, as I kind of mentioned earlier, there's a lot of different interest in using TEs in a lot of different contexts, kind of from servers down to edge sensors. Existing TE systems don't really give a great, they're kind of locked to a specific instance. We also are looking for kind of cleaner interfaces between all of the different players in the TE space. You have the person who manufactures the hardware, you have the person who actually transforms that hardware into a product, and then you have people writing software for all of that. Right now that's kind of fragmented, and notably manufacturers generally can't anticipate what people are going to do down the line with that hardware. And so we want to pull away from having the manufacturer decide the entire functionality of that TE platform. We also want to minimize the trusted computing base here. The idea being, if you don't need features in your TEE system, you shouldn't have those features in your TEE system. This also really improves the feasibility of verification. So pulling your TCB down to thousands of lines of code is kind of in our space. And finally, it allows kind of rapid development of security features. So one of the things we've been doing with Keystone is starting to use it as a platform for TEE research, which is a lot of what it can be valuable for. It makes it easy to kind of iterate on designs. So the model here is that the platform provider, that is the person who's going to actually operate the hardware, and the Enclave developer can kind of customize the final TEE that results. So we provide a framework of software that you use on top of a set of compatible RISC-V hardware. If your TEE is going to be some little edge device, maybe what you need is libc support. You need attestation, obviously. Maybe you need multi-threading and like secure timers. So you compose a TEE using Keystone that does that, and that's all you have. And so it's very small. If you need more support, you need secure I/O, dynamic memory allocation, side channel protections. You incorporate those features as well. Keystone provides the majority of these, and then you are good to go, and you have a more complex TEE, but you're only using the features that you need. All of this is available on KeystoneEnclave.org. There is real hardware out there that you can run our stuff on, although you can't run the secure boot on it because it doesn't have a root of trust. We have to simulate that. And you can kind of mess around with it there. We have both emulation and hardware stuff that you can use. So let's talk about the actual, the framework here in the internals. So again, at the bottom, we have a set of trusted hardware. This is we kind of start with the assumption that someone has built a RISC-V core. It's got a root of trust with keys in it. We can talk about the different trust models for that keying and how that keying process can work, but we're starting from the software layer with Keystone. So we assume that this trusted hardware has been built. It doesn't really do much though. On top of that, in RISC-V, you have three privilege modes. The most privileged of these is machine mode, or M mode. In M mode, we run what we call the security monitor, which is kind of a reference monitor style design. The security monitor is not in charge of resource allocations. It's not in charge of scheduling. It's in charge of enforcing security guarantees. On top of this, you have a legacy management stack, which is a commodity operating system. Right now, we support Linux. We will support other kind of embedded, RTOSes and stuff in the future. And then you have your user mode applications. So that's supervisor mode and user mode above that. And these are regular unmodified stuff. We load a driver into Linux, but otherwise nothing here has been changed. And then in parallel, what Keystone lets you do is run a semi-arbitrary, based on some hardware restrictions, number of enclaves. And unlike a lot of other systems, each enclave has its own supervisor mode code component here, which we call the runtime, as well as its user mode application. Now, an application can be an unmodified RISC-V binary with sufficient supervisor mode support. It can also be a natively written Keystone application. So we support kind of both of those modes. And notably, each enclave has its own unique runtime. So they can be different runtimes. So one application can be running a supervisor mode component in its enclave that is very minimal. It's kind of like a minimal shim just so that it can talk to the untrusted OS. Another one can actually be running a full-blown microkernel inside of its own enclave. So how does Keystone actually customize these TEEs? The workflow here that we envision it being used for is that there's a hardware manufacturer who manufactures some hardware, as I said, with keys. There's then somebody who's going to be operating this hardware. This may or may not be the end software developer or user. They use Keystone to build a customized security monitor to that hardware. They're then able to deploy that, running a legacy stack on top. There's somebody who in parallel is developing an application. They again use Keystone to develop an application and a runtime. We provide a modular runtime component, which I'll talk about later, as well as supporting SEL4 as a runtime. And then they can deploy this on the hardware and they get attestation guarantees. There's a more complex figure here that I actually should have removed that kind of explains all the individual pieces that go into this.
So can you just, for a second, so you've mentioned this, the attestation guarantees and some of the other things. What are the guarantees that you're making
Yeah. So
to whom are you making them? I mean, there's the confidentiality, but
right.
I'm trying to understand, you know, how the root of trust plays in here with the integrity pieces of it as well.
Right. So the part here that gets a little bit complicated is we need to start by defining how the keying and root of trust model is going to work. Our expectation is that different hardware manufacturers are going to have different models for different products and different systems. Now, the simplest possible example here is that the hardware manufacturer puts a public and private key into every piece of hardware that they manufacture. That key is only accessible to the bootloader and nothing else. They then publish the public keys for each of those devices, saying these are authentic public keys for our devices. At that point, the attestation process will guarantee you, the remote user of one of these machines, that your application has been securely loaded into an enclave, that application is properly isolated. It will give you a report detailing what specific security mitigations are in place for that platform, and it'll allow you to establish a secure channel piggybacking off of that report. And all of that will be tied to the public-private key pair that that particular processor has.
Okay. And so if I want third-party verification,
we would have to
assume that the public key-private key pair is a root of trust for...
Right. So if you have a root of trust model where something closer to Intel's model, where they like run a server and there's the IaaS stuff, that's also an option. The Keystone software starts at the point under the assumption that we can derive a key that we can sign reports with and that the other person will verify it. And we have an example implementation that does this kind of really simple public-private key pair model, but the majority of Keystone stuff is above that layer, if that makes sense.
Yep. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, so let's get into some actual technical details here, how the security monitor works and why we're excited about, like, why we do this on RISC-V and what this buys us. So the big thing that this buys us is RISC-V's physical memory protection mechanism. So this is a feature that is supported in essentially all fully featured RISC-V chips. It's a standard. There will be upcoming changes to that standard, I'm pretty sure. It consists of essentially a number of entries, maximum 8 or 16, depending on the chip, that maximum should be going up, that are ordered in priority. So PMP0 is the highest priority and PMPN is the lowest priority. And these are going to be matched for address regions on all memory accesses. So if we pretend that all of DRAM is down here, PMP applies to supervisor and user mode. It does not apply to machine mode. We can set a whitelisted entry in PMP0 with read-write execute permissions for a given address range. So now PMP0 says that this particular chunk of DRAM is accessible to supervisor and user mode. We can also, if we're starting the security monitor, what we actually do is we're going to blacklist the security monitor's memory region. This is to protect it from the operating system and from other applications. And this is the first thing that kind of happens after the bootloader runs. We use the highest priority entry here because the security monitor is going to never be accessible to supervisor and user mode. We can then also, in the lowest priority entry, we put an entry that gives default read-write-execute access. And this is so that the operating system, the host OS, Linux, has access to all of memory by default, except for the security monitor. And again, this is because the security monitor is not doing resource allocations, it's not doing management. That's the job of the host OS. So now, if a memory access comes in from supervisor or user mode, it will match on PMP0 first, and then match on PMPN last. And so if it tries to access the first chunk of memory, it'll fail, otherwise it'll succeed. We can now boot the operating system as normal. It gets the access to the rest of DRAM. Now, when we want to create an enclave, the OS will allocate a contiguous chunk of memory. We use the Linux CMA allocator. It's kind of irrelevant what mechanism you use to get a chunk of contiguous memory, although it does need to be contiguous. The OS or the user application then loads that with the enclave code and data. So there's some initial page mappings that go in there. There is the runtime supervisor mode component, and there is the application component, as well as any extra memory that enclave will want to use. At that point, this is still modifiable by the adversary. Once it is handed to the security monitor and said, I would like you to create an enclave here, it does some sanity checks, making sure it doesn't overlap with other existing enclaves, and then allocates one of the currently unused PMP entries to isolate that enclave from the rest of the system. So once it is isolated, the security monitor can then do measurement to ensure the integrity of the enclave code and data and use that measurement in the attestation report that it gives to the user. Now that it's isolated, it's inaccessible to supervisor and user mode components from then on. Now when we want to execute that enclave, what's going to happen is the user in the regular host operating world is going to request a context switch into the enclave. That context switch will go from the user space via system call to the host OS, and then via what's called an environment call or an SBI, supervisor binary interface, to the secure monitor asking to context switch into an enclave.
So just a quick question on the context switch. So the structure, you know, with the supervisor mode and the user mode, in this, it kind of looks like a lightweight VM. When you think of context switches, should I think of VM enter, VM exit, or should I think of, you know, from an SGX side of things, OCall, ECall? How heavyweight is this context switch?
On RISC-V, these end up being relatively cheap. Okay. It's somewhere between the two. And it kind of depends on what mitigation features are currently enabled. So if you have cache partitioning and cache flushing turned on in the security monitor between,
it's going to be more. It's going to be a lot.
It's going to be more expensive.
Yep.
If you have it down to kind of the minimal version, where you have memory isolation and all you have is memory isolation, it's very fast.
Okay. Thanks.
Also, obviously, we have multiple PMP entries. We can do this kind of ad nauseum at runtime to create an arbitrary number of these enclaves until we run out of PMP entries. Now, when we want a context switch in, what we're going to do is essentially we're going to modify two of these PMP entries. We're going to need to change the PMP entry for the enclave we want to run. So if we want to switch to enclave 2, we're going to need to modify its PMP entry. And we're also going to need to modify the base PMP entry that we're using for the OS. So we essentially turn on access to the enclave memory and turn off access to the rest of memory. And we do this because we don't want to privilege enclaves higher than the host OS, right? The enclave should not have more privileges, and so it's only able to access its own memory. Now, the really big advantage of this is because we are doing this isolation at the physical memory layer and not at the virtual addressing layer, this is what lets an enclave run its own supervisor mode component. So because it's completely isolated to a physical memory region, we can let it do its own virtual page management, we can let it write its own page tables, it can have essentially full supervisor mode privileges because the only things memory-wise it can affect are in its own memory space that is isolated from the rest of the system. So again, these do look a little bit like lightweight VMs in this context, but they don't need to have, their supervisor mode component can be extremely small. When we want a context switch out of the enclave and back to the host, it's relatively simple. Again, we change the base entry that we use, and we flip the access to the enclave memory back off. Now, the problem with this kind of simple version of the model is that the enclave and the host have no way of communicating because they don't share any memory spaces. So we do actually have an additional shared memory component. When we want to destroy a enclave, we have the security monitor zeroes out the memory associated with that enclave and then deallocates the PMP entry. So one of the cool things about doing all of this in software that's really easy to modify is we can kind of augment the security monitor for different threat models. And this is what I was kind of getting at a second ago. So in the default model here, what we have is if we have a shared cache, and these are all, Everything I'm going to talk about here are modules that we've built that work currently with one specific hardware platform, but you could build different extensions for different hardware platforms. If we have a shared last level cache, the idea might be that all of those entries go into DRAM. That may or may not be good for us. So one thing we might want to do is cache partitioning. This would defend us against a host that is able to run cache side channel attacks of kind of any variety. We can partition the cache into components for the enclave and components for the untrusted world. We can do that kind of at runtime. We decide we would like to partition the cache such that the enclave gets this percentage of the cache and it gets access to that. We're using a customizable L2 cache controller on the Hi5 board, which we do a lot of our development on, that lets us do this partitioning. We can also run chips run enclaves entirely in on-chip memory. So we built a scratchpad memory system on top of, again, the same L2 controller that allows us to run an enclave and security monitor entirely in the last level cache, and so they never touch DRAM. This is advantageous if you're concerned about a physical adversary who will have access to your DRAM. Now, the problem with this particular, the basic version of this, is that you're limited to the memory space in your last level cache. So what we do is we have a 2 meg cache, we allocate 1 meg of it. That might be enough if the application that you're running is like a really small edge device, sensor management tool. It's not going to be enough if you're doing something more complicated. We also then built kind of a software proof of concept page encryption and decryption and integrity protection scheme. So what this lets us do is, like SGX, it lets us move pages out to DRAM, but when we do, those pages are encrypted and integrity protected specific to that enclave. And we can do all of this in the supervisor mode component inside of the enclave. So the security monitor actually doesn't get involved here. It's all done by the enclave itself. And so then it can move pages in and out. Now this is like incredibly slow because we're doing this in software. Hopefully in the future, we will get access to some hardware IP that will allow us to integrate a memory encryption engine similar to how SGX does. And then we will be able to do that encryption back and forth of pages kind of faster. But we support kind of all of these modes, and the idea is that when you're putting together a security monitor for a given platform, like we did for the Hi5, you would take the hardware features that are available on it, you would write plugins to the security monitor that use those features to provide additional security guarantees, and then when an enclave starts up, it can request some subset of those security guarantees, and the attestation report will say which of those guarantees it was able to provide.
When I think about the different configurations that you have here, are these different pieces of hardware that you've gone through with the customization?
No,
This is just different incarnations of the security monitor, and that is how you affect the different.
Right. So the security monitor, we have a C implementation and a Rust implementation right now. It's essentially writing the scratchpad, for example, the on-chip enclave execution variant is a couple hundred lines of code in our for our plugin for the Hi5. So we're able to kind of enable that functionality pretty easily. Yes. We also have stuff, extensions like dynamically resizing an enclave. So this is something, earlier I was saying when you allocate that contiguous memory for an enclave, you need to know how much memory that enclave will need. If you decide you need more memory, we've written an extension where a enclave can request the host operating system to extend its memory boundaries if possible, and then the host OS can tell the security monitor to extend the boundaries of that enclave's memory space. Now, this may or may not leak information depending on your application's construction, so you may or may not want this feature. The advantage we're trying to highlight here is that, again, we're able to do this, take the existing security monitor and the existing system that we have, and then with less than 200 lines of code and like 2 days, we're able to build a working extension implementation.
So what is the implication for the attestation of this?
So the attestation will give you a guarantee about the code and data that was loaded before the enclave started executing.
Okay, so
attestation will not.
Odd things may happen if I extend the memory and I'm on my own. For how
it should it. No, it so it should be right if your memory extension will come from the code, the request to extend the memory would come from code that was covered by that attestation guarantee, and the extended memory would be zeroed when it's given to you. So that's essentially safe. Does that make sense?
Yep. Oh, yeah, I got it.
Yeah. Again, this is more of an example of kind of what it takes to add features to Keystone here. I'm also going to kind of talk a little bit about the runtime here. So earlier I showed you this more complex example of kind of how Keystone works. And there's these runtime components. There's the security monitor components. All of these have kind of additional modules that you can put into them. And I was talking about these with the security monitor. We have some that are, you know, hardware platform based. We also have some additional ones that are kind of feature based and are tied to a specific piece of hardware. So with the runtime, this is the supervisor mode component that runs inside of an enclave. We have this kind of exemplar modular runtime that we've written. You can strip it all the way down to, I think it's a few hundred, it's less than 1,000, I think, lines of code. Or you can extend it by adding features, and those are chosen at compile time. So when you build your runtime, you say, I would like the following features in it. And so we have stuff that gives you like side channel, we have, you know, things that give you additional defenses, but most runtime components are going to be functionality based. Most security features are going to come from the security monitor. So things in the runtime are like virtual memory management, accessing I/O via the untrusted world, those types of things. So at the most basic layer, you can, if you create an enclave that is extremely simple, you can do a static virtual to physical memory mapping, and the enclave will not actually have the functionality to change its own virtual mappings. One of the basic plugins that we have that's kind of needed for a lot of the other things is basic virtual memory management inside of your own enclave. So you turn that on, and now you can do your own virtual to physical mappings while the enclave is running. We also have a kind of edge call interface. This looks similar to how SGX does O calls and E calls. Our names for them are going to be slightly different because unfortunately E call means something different and very important in RISC-V. So we have to come up with slightly different names. But this is, we have a shared memory buffer that both the host world and the enclave have access to, and they can use it to do like an RPC style mechanism to pass information between each other for calls.
Before we go off on this, and this kind of references back to your earlier comment about shared memory. I know one of the things we found in writing the SGX applications is that the context switches are the things that kill you, right? It's the O call and E call and the complexity of that. And anytime you're doing VM level versions of it's orders of magnitude worse, right? So shared memory has become, between the untrusted and trusted, has been one of the methods that we get really big performance improvements out of that.
Right.
Are you suggesting that we're going to be able to do that with the shared buffer in this kind of example, in the edge call interface example?
So you're talking about like stuff like hot calls?
Exit lists, kind of. Okay,
So that type of stuff. So you could do that with this. We haven't actually written the hot calls variant of this. Mm-hmm. Currently, what we do is all the calls are synchronous, but you could make them asynchronous since we're doing everything through a shared memory construct. You would need two cores.
Yeah, and the other noticeable factor here is that our O calls and E calls are significantly cheaper.
Yes.
Than the SGX version. I think it's like 5,000
spiders. It's a few thousand. In worst cases.
Right. So last time someone was asking us, what is there any scope of optimization with exitless calls? And when we gave them the numbers, they're like, oh, this is, you know, already.
It's already cheap.
Cheap. So it doesn't fetch you any more performance, especially in terms of context switches. Now, the expensive part here is, of course, making memory copies in the sense if you want to pass a buffer, you have to, in SGX, you can sort of keep that buffer outside the enclave. But in our case, you have to keep that in the shared buffer because that's the only memory space which is accessible to both the host and the enclave.
Okay, so I still have to do an explicit copy to move it in rather than just a read access to it. Okay.
So the way that we currently have this implemented is that the host application works directly in the shared buffer. That's because it's running in the untrusted world, and the buffer is considered completely untrusted, and so it's kind of fine for it to work in there. The Enclave application, we actually don't map it into its virtual memory space. We map it into the runtime's virtual memory space. And so the application cannot inadvertently read or write to the shared buffer and thus leak access patterns or read stale data, you know, double reads and that kind of thing. And so instead we have a set of tools to do all of that through the runtime. And so that way it's kind of, we've focused access of that shared buffer to a single point. And so it's easier to defend it there.
Okay, thanks.
But yes, this is a relatively flexible mechanism. Right now we have a very naive RPC kind of model where it uses the shared buffer, but we could do, there's a lot of stuff you could build on top of that. We allow kind of syscalls to go all the way out to the host OS. This is not safe by default, right? You're going to be vulnerable to a variety of Iago attacks as well as other mechanisms. We've built a naive kind of benchmarking IO version of this where we can proxy all your basic IO syscalls out to the host world transparently. So the Enclave application just makes a open, you know, read, write calls. The runtime gets those as regular syscalls and then is able to proxy those out to the host. This is useful for talking to files. If you're talking over the network, you know, you can establish a encrypted tunnel to the trusted Enclave application, and we have a demo showing how to do that using Libsodium. And then the fact that it's going over this kind of untrusted IO interface is less dangerous. Existing defensive work on Iago attacks would slot very well into the runtime. We're looking at porting some stuff. Shweta has a lot of work in this space. That is highly relevant to allowing applications to transparently use kind of host syscalls, but in a safe manner. Note, as we were just saying though, data that is going through here will need to be copied into and out of the shared buffer, which is not trivially cheap. We also allow other basic system calls. This is again a support that you can build in at compile time to the runtime for things like basic mmaps for anonymous regions. We don't have file mmaps working yet. Break, get random, stuff like that. And those never leave the trusted world. So the Enclave application makes a syscall. That is a normal syscall. There's no modification needed. It goes to the runtime. The runtime may or may not need the security monitor's assistance in that. So for example, get random, it'll need the security monitor's assistance since the security monitor is the one that has the random interface. And this lets you support kind of basic libc functionality inside of the Enclave without needing the host. We've also booted the SEL4 microkernel as an example of a different style of runtime component. So again, this is getting a little bit closer to a tiny kind of weird virtual machine. We needed to modify the boot process a little bit, but otherwise we can boot and run SEL4 inside of one of the enclaves. So when you're starting up an enclave, you can say, I would like SEL4 to be my runtime. Here's a copy of SEL4. Here is my application. Please load them. We also have some basic evaluation numbers. I can skim through these pretty quickly. These are really just more to show that you can run this stuff. There shouldn't be any surprises in these. We've booted and run Keystone-based systems on a variety of FPGA soft cores, so Rocket-based RISC-V cores, the Boom out-of-order RISC-V core, and the FU540, which is the hardware Hi-5 platform we've been working on. As Linux-capable RISC-V SoCs come out, we will build Keystone support for them. unsurprisingly, if you're running a CPU-bound benchmarking suite inside of the Enclave, you have this initialization latency that's proportional to the size of the application or the benchmark. That's because you have to do this measurement process when you first create the Enclave. That dominates your initialization. There's no meaningful overhead. That's because when an Enclave is running, it has control of that core. And so you don't see any CPU overheads. I/O, again, we have this kind of naive I/O proxying that we built. This is showing the numbers for different record sizes and file sizes for not running Keystone, both reading and writing. Keystone experiences non-trivial performance overheads. Again, that's because you're doing the copies through the shared buffer. So you have an additional copy that's going to put additional cache pressure on you, that sort of thing. This should not come as a major surprise. It's kind of the inevitable result of having to do copies. There's also performance trade-offs that you can do with the defensive modules that I was talking about earlier. So this is kind of some results for running cache partitioning. So if we 50-50 partition the cache between the Enclave application and the host world, we see overheads kind of like we would expect, which is to say that they're going to be based on working set size. So orange here is running just in Keystone. Gray is running in the host world only. And blue is running in Keystone with cache partitioning. The lighter colored bars on top are initialization overheads. Those are larger on here than they should be due to some software implementation issues we're having right now with measurement. The darker colored bars on the bottom are runtime. So those are the numbers you should be really focusing on. So if you look at some of these, you'll see that you experience an overhead because you only have 50% of the cache available to you. You've partitioned it out. Some things experience really serious performance overheads. That's because they have very large working set sizes. Other things have essentially no overhead because their working set size is very small. Again, this is what you would expect if you're partitioning the cache. Large working set, you see overheads. Small, you don't. The flush overheads here are not a significant overhead if you're flushing, because we flush the chunk of the cache as you switch back and forth. We also did some experiments with on-chip execution and memory encryption. These are overheads in percents. This is control. This is just running inside of the Keystone just by itself. This is cache partitioning overheads. Again, things with large working set sizes see serious overheads. Everything else doesn't. Once you do on-chip execution and self-paging, so this is where it's able to page stuff out to DRAM, but otherwise runs on-chip, you start seeing very serious penalties for things that need to page a lot. Once you add in encryption to that, it gets significantly more expensive. Some things just become completely untenable to run. It's entirely based on essentially, again, how big your memory space is. If you have a large memory space, you incur a lot of page faults as you need to swap pages in and out of the on-chip memory, and that's expensive. Hardware support for this would drastically improve it. We also did basic dynamic resizing. This was really useful for really large, we did a bunch of machine learning benchmarking for really large things that are like some of the stuff we were running in the machine learning benchmarks that are hundreds of megabytes. This was really useful because we didn't need to predefine the size of the Enclave. We could just let the OS extend its memory space as long as it had contiguous memory available. There's low overheads there because the memory extension process is essentially instant. It does not cost much. It's just one context switch back and forth. Okay, so can we run a bunch of kind of real-world apps in this? Again, we ran a bunch of these Torch machine learning and fan models in there. We also have a demo that demonstrates how to do secure computation inside of an Enclave after establishing an encrypted tunnel to it from a remote user. So we can push the Enclave over to the platform, ask the Enclave to run, get an attestation report, bind a secure channel to that attestation report so that we know we're talking to our Enclave, and then send messages to it and have it do basic computation. And we have a demo showing how to do that. We've got a paper on archive. There's two versions of it right now. For additional details, it's linked from our website as well. Kind of upcoming for Keystone, there's an enormous effort right now for getting us onto upstream versions of a lot of stuff. When Keystone started, we were on a lot of kind of older forks for RISC-V. Those forks have been pushed upstream. We are now moving to upstream on a lot of that stuff, which should help with support for newer hardware. There's little ongoing verification efforts. Sure, they can answer questions about those. We're working on kind of doing some hardware root of trust integrations. So this is kind of, as I said, right now we're emulating that in software because we don't have an exemplar hardware platform that has a root of trust with keying. We want to try and get one of those done. We have a Rust security monitor rewrite right now. We're going to be doing some more experimentation with that. Currently, we only support RISC-V 64-bit. We're also almost able to support right now RISC-V 32-bit, which will help us for embedded platforms, IoT platforms that don't run the 64-bit stuff. So that's kind of Keystone, talking about what we're doing with it right now, some of the internals, and how you can use it to kind of trade off security, functionality, size, all of this stuff. We have a website, there's talks on there, there's additional documentation, demos, all of that sort of stuff. If you want to get started with it, you can boot it on QEMU. We've tested this on RISC-V boards, FPGAs, FireSim. We do most of our development in QEMU, but you can use any of this stuff and it should work. And we have instructions for the majority of them. We obviously have a great team. This is not everyone even on it. We have a large group of undergrads that are actually working on it now as well who aren't even on here. But it's been we're growing that fast. Thank you. And we can take kind of additional questions. I think there's another stuff. Thanks.
I'm having a hard time getting off my mute button. So first, let me just ask, does anybody else have questions at this point? All right, so I'll throw mine out there, which is, you know, we are all in the business of building these DLT platforms, or at least the components that are fitting into them. And I know that at least in my conversations with Don, Keystone is clearly connected to Oasis and some of the other things. Can you talk to us a little bit about how we would go about starting to use this? What is the, you know, when you think about how to use Keystone to make blockchain or decentralized applications better, how do you imagine it being used? And where should we start with that?
Yeah, so the quick caveat here is that both Jordan and I are not kind of blockchain space people. We're systems people primarily. But right, Don's strong interest in this is in using it as an alternative to things like homomorphic encryption. So there are scenarios in which you would like to be able to do computation at speed for smart contracts. This is something that a lot, not just Oasis, right, but lots of people are interested in doing and using a TE for. So if you can, as part of your smart contract process, use the fact that you have a TE on that machine that is, its trust model is bound to your ledger technology, you can run that computation kind of in the clear inside of the TE rather than having to do a encrypted computation.
And that gets us tremendous performance benefits, obviously.
Right, because you're just running at speed on the core. Mm-hmm. Now, you have memory limitations, you have all those sorts of things, but you do get the number crunching.
Right. Sorry, go ahead, Hart.
I was going to follow that up with a question. Wouldn't you want to do sort of functional encryption instead of just pure homomorphic encryption? And have you guys looked into like implementing one of the functional encryption schemes? Like I just posted a paper in the chat link.
It'll take me a second to open it, but yeah. I'm going to stop.
No worries. I guess the question is, have you considered functional encryption?
Sorry, do you have a good answer?
So I think irrespective of either we are using, so this should be possible with Keystone as well. Whatever they're doing with SGX should be possible with Keystone. We have not done head-to-head comparisons.
Yeah.
One of the reasons is we are not trying to run blockchain.
Right. As I said, we're not. We're primarily system security people, and like we want to support people building, you know, DLT stuff on top, but that's not the world that the two of us at least live in.
So to answer your question quickly, we know that there are, like, T is one way of not doing homomorphic encryption, but we are not innovating on those aspects. We are assuming people are already convinced why you want to use a TE, and they're looking for options other than SGX, for instance.
This is the sort of thing that the paper you just linked is a good example of the stuff that we want to go show that, yes, you can apply this model to the Keystone stuff as well. There should be no reason that you can't.
And to answer the previous questions, that what are the other things we can do using Keystone, especially in terms of blockchain, we have thought about private blockchain stuff where you may want to do operations where your data is encrypted on your ledger, but there are updates or you want to run some program on top of it. And so you can specify in your blockchain or in your contract that this has to be operated only in a secure TE, probably with this attestation report and so on. So that's one of the things. People have already proposed this and used SGX for. We feel Keystone can kind of be a drop-in replacement for that.
I think, that's the key here is essentially models where people were like, oh, I would like to use SGX in the following way to extend it. We expect Keystone to be deployable in a lot more scenarios than an Intel processor is. So right now, RISC-V platforms or RISC-V hardware primarily targets the application core and embedded space. And so Keystone can then operate there. In the future, I expect to see RISC-V targeting the more compute heavy examples, although that'll take some time, and then Keystone can operate there. And so we're talking about kind of a wider space of deployment than just SGX would be.
And I think the last thing is better consensus protocols.
Yes.
Things like proof of elapsed time and so on is something we would really like to run on Keystone. Unfortunately, as David was saying, we don't really have a secure root of trust, and things like monotonic counters have not been implemented yet. So we're not advertising things.
Yeah, we're not advertising the switches yet.
Elapsed time yet.
But we could do it.
But that's the other thing we're looking for.
So I shouldn't tell you that we have a version of Poet that doesn't need monotonic counters then, right?
Okay.
Well, we can give you monotonic counters if you
want. maybe we should talk. So.
You could do Poet without SGX.
Yeah. So the flip side question on this, given that, I work for Intel, I'm going to be a little bit careful about how I ask this, but so a lot of times it's easy for us to talk about the things that we're good at. So when I look at Keystone, what is it not appropriate for in this kind of trusted computing space? It feels a little bit like the attestation pieces are still the sort of third party attestation for independent integrity checks is going to be a little tough right now. Are there other things that it's not yet ready for?
So the big one is stuff that RISC-V hardware doesn't support. So as I said, if you want to run heavy cloud compute right now, there aren't RISC-V cores that are going to do that for you. They don't exist right now. And so we can't build the example to say, yes, Keystone is relevant to this. What else are we kind of bad on right now?
The other one is lack of an ME.
Yeah, that's true.
So our pitch is that you can have different threat models. And depending on your threat model, you can choose, you know, what trade-offs you want to make. Now, if someone, some use cases, like, for example, this functional encryption use case, where you're going to the extreme of using homomorphic encryption, clearly you are, you don't want to get attacked by a physical adversary. And that's why you're going to that extreme. And so when you replace that with Keystone, you have a software implementation, which is, I would, it's still better than homomorphic encryption or functional encryption, but it's slower than, for instance, SGX, right? Just because we do not have that hardware piece in there, and the other thing is it's not optimized as well as Intel SGX is, right? So we're not doing Merkle tree optimizations and you know all of that. So that is another use case where if you are looking for performance as well as a very strict security model, then probably Keystone is an option, but it's not.
That's only with hardware support that we don't have, right? That's hardware we haven't built that is not going to be built anytime soon. Another thing that I think we can sometimes have problems with is we're limited by the number of PMP entries available per platform. As I said, that's either 8 or 16 currently. If you wanted to run 100 separate enclaves, we have some ideas about kind of virtualizing the PMP entries. That requires some additional work that hasn't been done and will incur overheads as well. And so, you know, with SGX, I don't know, remember what the limitations are.
No, but it's much
But it's there. Much higher in terms of discrete number of enclaves that you can execute. We're limited by the number of PMP entries. Along with that, and this is kind of something that's currently going through the RISC-V standards process, is secure IO access. So we don't have, so in TrustZone, you can have transactions on a bus that are tagged as belonging to the secure world. We can debate how good that model ends up being in terms of actual security, but they do have a way to have a secure path to an IO or another peripheral. We don't have that right now because the RISC-V standards don't have that kind of IO physical memory protection mechanisms yet. Those are coming. And once they do, we will be able to integrate with them. But we don't, we can't do that yet, essentially.
Okay, good. So we are out of time and I have a hard stop. Are there any additional questions before we sign off for today? Your contact information is in the paper. So if anybody has questions, they can follow up with you there. David,
yep.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I have a website. If you, GitHub issues are also a good way, and we do have a mailing list as well.
Okay.
All that stuff.
Outstanding. Thanks so much for coming in. I know I will be contacting you.
Yeah, please do.
Some more. Don keeps trying to get me to come down. so we need to spend some time together and talk on that. Yeah, so, sure. Super. And again, I'll say thank you for today, and I will be stopping the recording at this point. So thanks.
Thank you.